Hello and welcome to the Symantec Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today are Symantec threat researchers, the O'Gormans, Bridget O'Gorman and Gavin O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking once again mostly about ransomware. That's because, unfortunately, there's been a number of high-profile incidents in recent weeks that really warrant some discussion. Probably the most significant incident is the attack on Ireland's National Health Service, the Health Service Executive, or HSE for short. On Friday, May 14th, news broke that it had been affected by a major ransomware attack that had affected virtually all of its areas of operations. The impact of this attack is something we've seen firsthand, since a lot of our team, including everyone on the podcast today, actually is based in Ireland. In the middle of a global pandemic, thousands of appointments every day are being cancelled, staff are being forced to keep paper records as computers stay offline, and even paying vital staff such as nurses has proved to be challenging. Right now, as I speak, nearly 3 weeks after the attack, the HSE is still working to restore its systems. Its chief executive, Paul Reid, this week estimated that the total cost of cleanup and remediation would probably reach around 100 million euros. So joining us today is Gavin, who's been following this attack quite closely and has been investigating a number of similar attacks in recent weeks, so probably has some very good insights to share. So welcome to the podcast again, Gavin. I guess maybe we could start by asking, what do we know so far about this ransomware attack and how did it unfold?
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, it's always good to have the O'Gorman duo together again on the podcast. Like you say, it started on the Friday. I think most people probably saw it about in the newspaper. And then over the next few days, little bits and pieces of data started to trickle out. And I think some of the interesting things that came out, of course, were that the ransomware deployed was called Conti. So that's quite a well-known and quite prevalent variant of ransomware. And that is a ransomware as a service is the model that's used. And it's quite interesting. The approach is pretty straightforward, where you have one group of attackers, we'll call them, who develop the Conti ransomware. So they actually write the actual program that is the Conti ransomware. And they also offer a service whereby they will sell a copy of that ransomware variant to what are called affiliates, so basically customers, essentially. And then it's up to those customers to figure out how to get that ransomware onto some victim computer. So those customers will go off and they'll figure out some way, like try and compromise the target by email, will I try and get into a web browser. Whatever way they can, they'll try and compromise victims. And then they will deploy the ransomware once they spread around on the victim's network. At that point, control is essentially handed over to the Conti gang. They're the ones who handle interacting with any victims, demanding a ransom, getting the payment of the ransom, and then actually paying out money to the affiliate, the customer that originally got the victim infected in the first place. So it's a fairly complex, I suppose, model in that it's basically, this is organized crime. There's no two ways about it. This is multiple different parties all colluding together in order to defraud an organization. And that's exactly what happened, obviously, in the case of the HSE, that this ransom was demanded. It's not just the ransom to have your data decrypted, but it's also a ransom to demand that any data stolen is not leaked by the attackers as well. And of course, that's a double-edged sword. I mean, you can decrypt your data, you can get the decryption key, and that's fine. You know, that's something that's transactional. You pay the money, you get the thing, and it's tangible, you get that. Whereas, of course, if the data is leaked, you have absolutely no control over whether or not, if you pay a ransom, the attacker will then not choose to leak that data. And so that's, you know, one of the serious risks, I think, of these types of ransomware. But anyway, back to the HSE compromise. It was quite interesting, and it later emerged that there'd actually been an attack against the Department of Health on the Thursday, the day before the HSE attack. It appears that actually was probably the same actual attack. It was the same ransomware. The Department of Health had been able to block it, and the HSC, unfortunately, were not able to block it, and it was able to run rampant, essentially, through the HSC network, with the result then that the data was encrypted and that the data was allegedly stolen as well. The Conti attackers claim they stole 700 gigabytes or so of data. At that point, you know, the general process for any government or critical infrastructure organizations in Ireland, at least, and it's generally the same across Europe, the National Cybersecurity Center for that country will then be called in to assist the victim. So it's not a case that the NCSC arrive in and start actually doing an investigation or start securing networks. They arrive in to provide advice. And in this case, the advice was that, you need to lock down the network. You need to get in an incident response company and basically start rebuilding your network as quickly as possible. And that's what the HSC have done and are still doing. It's quite a lengthy process to rebuild a network like that, I think.
And you mentioned it ran rampant across the HSC. And I guess for our listeners who may not be familiar with Ireland, I mean, it's a very diverse organization. There's hospitals, there's little clinics here, there and everywhere, there's offices, you know. How exactly, do we know much about how exactly they managed to spread the ransomware into so many different locations?
So we don't know details of HSE specifically, but certainly from other victims where we've seen similar activity, the typical process is that the attackers will get in through some route. Maybe it's through email, perhaps there's some sort of, there's a couple of botnets out there where once the attackers get access through a particular, say, a banking Trojan, maybe they discover that the victim is not, performing online banking for a machine. And so they resell access to that machine. They'll go find somebody and they'll say, look, I've got an interesting victim. I will sell access to you for X amount of money. And so that's one way people might get in. Perhaps open remote desktop protocol servers, basically insecure ones, or using poor passwords and so on. So basically, it's a whole bunch of different ways attackers use to get in. Once they do get in, then they will typically, as all of these attackers do, they'll make their way to a domain controller, they'll start dumping passwords, they'll start mapping out the network, literally listing out what machines are on the network, what domain controllers are on the network. Get admin credentials for the network. And at that point, once they've done that, they're in a position then to very, very easily use some tool like PSExec, which is like a remote execution tool, to start deploying the ransomware across the entire network. And it varies. Like some attackers will actually, they'll take that approach, they'll ransom or they'll encrypt every machine. Others are a little bit more choosy in that they'll basically go after a couple of very important machines like file servers, and they will encrypt those. And so they don't bother, to encrypt all the machines on the network. They just simply pick the ones with the data, knowing that if the victim wants to get that data back and doesn't have backups, then forced to pay the ransom if they have no other avenues. And so that is, that's typically the approach. And I would imagine it's a somewhat similar scenario in the HSE.
You described there's a lot of steps, I guess, between the initial intrusion and the actual ransomware execution. How long does it take? I mean, can this be done overnight, or is this is this going to take them a couple of weeks?
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. All right, I mean, you would see attackers getting in and performing encryption in some cases very quickly. Practically, it could be done within seconds or minutes of the malware coming in. There's no reason why that could not happen in some cases. In most cases, where they need to explore the network a bit more, you're talking maybe 10 or 12 hours on average we would see for that type of activity between time to get in and then deploy the ransomware. In the case where it's kind of this dual-pronged attack, I suppose, where both ransomware and data is stolen, those will tend to be longer. And the reason they're longer is because they have to steal the data, and it takes time to actually upload the data. In some cases, they will try and upload the data in a fairly subtle manner by restricting the bandwidth, for example, that's used to upload the data to, you know, quite a small capacity, so that, you know, somebody monitoring the network doesn't suddenly see a huge spike of bandwidth being used on the network. And then there's a second part as well, where they want to try and disable backups. So as backups are being made, they will try and encrypt those backups too. And, you know, most organizations, I would think, typically will have like 30 days of backups. And so that would need to be how long the attacker would be in to make sure all of those backups are effectively destroyed or rendered useless, such that when they do apply the ransom, of course, the victim can't fall back on the ransomware. So I guess to answer your question, I think it would range from around that period of 30 days or so up to or down to 10 to 12 hours or so.
Okay. You mentioned Conti as being the threat behind this attack. What, if anything, do we know about the people behind Conti? Are they the new kids on the block, or are they veteran cyber criminals?
Yeah, they certainly seem to have been around for some time. There's quite a bit of, you know, open source referencing of links between Conti ransomware, another ransomware family called Ryuk, and then Ryuk is supposedly linked to another e-crime malware called TripBot, which is a banking Trojan. And so there's quite a bit of a complex, I suppose you could say, around Conti, Ryuk, and TripBot. TripBot has been around for a long time, very prevalent. There's been quite a number of, I think, law enforcement actions against TripBot and the actors behind TripBot. So certainly there seems to be quite a bit of documentation about connections between those, but at the same time, I think a lot of that documentation is somewhat tentative. I mean, we haven't seen, for example, very hard, strong links to link between the two. It's some degree of speculation, I think. For example, you know, Ryuk was quite active for a while, and then Ryuk started to die away a little bit, and so Conti became a little bit more prevalent. So then there was speculation leading that there was a connection between the two. I think there was some language shared between the ransom, between Conti and Ryuk and stuff like that. So, you know, things that would point to relations, but maybe not like a solid hard link like, oh, we're seeing the same command and control domains being used consistently by Conti, or we've seen the exact same victims by Conti and Ryuk or other things like that.
Okay, yeah. And I guess the presence of affiliates now even complicates things, because you never really know if you're dealing with the original developers of the malware or just somebody who's renting it out or collaborating with these people over the short term.
Yeah, and that, you know, that does make analysis of the attacks a little bit more difficult, because of course, exactly, you've got multiple different people doing multiple different things to try and get access to a victim. And in some cases, one, you know, affiliate, they may not necessarily stick with one particular ransomware. They may actually use different ransomwares from different actors. And so you end up with just a bit of a mess, basically, of different actors deploying different tools at different times. And so it can be difficult to analyze. But I think once you start to see enough of the attacks happen, you build up enough data, you do start to be able to see patterns, I think, between the different affiliates. And certainly that's something that you know, we're looking into in a lot more detail now. And I think we should be able to identify affiliate activity leading to specific ransomware over time.
The attack, I think it shocked an awful lot of people. You know, as I've said earlier, it's in the middle of a global pandemic, and they attacked the National Health Service, which is, you know, hospitals and critical care. Did they know what they were doing? Did they know what organization they were compromising?
Yes, I think so. I think that I would not be surprised if the nature of the compromise was somewhat random. I mean, you know, like we say, with all the various affiliates, it's quite possible that affiliates found, you know, they might be scanning the internet all the time looking for open ODP machines. Pick a machine, get access to it. So that's pretty random as to, you know, what machine you're going to compromise or not. But once you do get onto that machine, you're going to look and see what's on the network. What IP address are you reporting in from? Is that IP associated with any organization? What is this organization? What's the shape, essentially, of the network? How is the network designed? And pretty quickly, you're going to figure out where you are, the number of machines that are on the network, type of data that's on that network. And at that point, then the affiliates make a decision as to whether or not they're going to, you know, deploy the ransomware. And in this case, they clearly made a decision that, yeah, they were going to deploy that ransomware. And then the Conti gang then continued with that activity, essentially. So, yeah, I think it's very much a deliberate choice to perform that attack against the HSE.
And do you think that the publicity around this attack, I kind of made the international news, do you think that would deter the gang in any way? You know, were they probably expecting this amount of blowback or bad press, as it were?
Yeah, I suspect perhaps. So, you know, of course, the health setup across the world is so different across different countries. You know, the how health is organized in Europe versus the US versus Eastern Europe, it's so different that I think it can be hard for people to understand exactly, you know, what does the HSE even mean? Is it a hospital, perhaps? Or is it, in fact, the national health body, you know, because a lot of countries wouldn't necessarily even have something like that. Yeah. And so maybe there was an element of that there was a little bit of a lack of understanding of the fact that this is a state body responsible for health and hospitals across the entire country. And so I think when, you know, of course, the media started discussing it and because of the nature of the attack, that it was that state body and had such an impact and it went public, I suspect that maybe attackers got a bit of a surprise purely based on the fact that they didn't follow through so far on leaking the data. They provided the decryption key to the HSE and the NCSC in Ireland. So that's very unusual. And I think, you know, there's a certain degree of pressure maybe on ransomware actors to actually follow through on their threats. Because if they don't, then obviously less people are going to be inclined to pay them their money. So, you know, it's in their business interest to follow through on their threats. And in this case, they didn't. And so there must be some reason why they didn't do that. And there's, you know, there's been speculation that perhaps as a result of the dark side attack against the Colonial Pipeline in the US, which is a somewhat similar scenario where a criminal gang has performed an attack which has resulted in impact at a national level, which essentially is you know, going to start influencing geopolitics, where, you know, you can't have a criminal element, a rogue element essentially, in a country performing activities that are going to cause trouble for the government in that country. And, you know, the speculation is that the Conti gang operate out of Russia. Speculation is that the dark side gang operate out of Russia. And so, you know, there's been much documentation about how the US have been pushing back on Russia for certainly related to the dark side attack. And so maybe there's an element of that, you know, somebody talked to somebody and said, you need to ease up on this. Basically, you can't be doing things like this because you're attracting too much attention. And it's not good for business, basically, to be attracting this much attention. And so, yeah, that's, you know, obviously that's total speculation, but I suspect there's an element of truth to that.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned the decryption key has been provided, which, you know, it's a good development from the HSE's perspective, but it doesn't really, you know, it's not a silver bullet, as it were. It doesn't really solve the issue overnight, does it?
No, not at all. I think, you know, there's a few issues with it. The first one is the actual reliability of it. So, you know, the a gang who has just broken onto your network and encrypted all of your files and is demanding money from you has now just given you a program that they want you to run on your network. Obviously, you're like, okay, well, I know I'm not going to do that. So you have to inspect, you have to first engineer that tool and figure out exactly how it works, what is it doing. And so that, you know, that takes a little bit of time. And then there's the actual quality of the tool. Like, there's much, you know, kind of commentary online about how when decryptors are provided, they tend to be very poorly written. They're inefficient. I think there are some examples of people who have paid a ransom and then the decryptor was so inefficient that they then actually only used it on a couple of machines because that was, you know, otherwise it was too slow. And so, you know, that is an element as well. And in this case, the approach you would take is you would reverse engineer the tool. You would build your own version with the decryption key. You would write a good version. And that would be then deployed. And I suspect that that is what was done by the incident response company and NCSC and HSE, was to actually develop their own version of the decryption tool, just simply using the key that was embedded in it. But even with that, you know, you can decrypt and you can recover files, but you still have to make sure that that network does not have any additional backdoors left on it. You need to make sure that passwords are changed. And across an organization of, I don't know how many employees are in the HSE. Is it around 100,000 or so? Is that the number?
This is something we should have checked before recording it. But needless to say, it's probably one of the biggest state bodies, if not the biggest state body in Ireland, and probably would have a huge workforce.
I mean, that's, you know, you're changing passwords for a massive population of users. And then you have to make sure that all of those machines are clean, because if one machine is not clean, it still has a backdoor on it, then, you know, the attackers can perform the same attack again. So it's a tough job. And the decryption key will help to retrieve data that, yeah, has been encrypted and you don't have a backup for. And I've no doubt that saved an awful lot of effort and heartache, I think, for HSE. But they still have to go through that laborious process of rebuilding and the entire network, and that's pretty painstaking. You know, I remember working on an investigation against there's an espionage attack several years ago, where a similar story, they'd been compromised, and an IR company came in to clean up the network. It took a while to clean it up, and they changed all the passwords, relaunched the network, and a day later, the attackers were back in, and it turned out that a sysadmin on the network had changed his password. But instead of, you know, changing his password properly, he'd change it from, you know, password 123 to password 1234 or something along those lines. It was like a tiny minor iteration, a tiny predictable minor iteration on his password. And so attackers back in. And that's what you're dealing with. That's the type of thing that, you know, you have to watch out for if you look at all that sort of stuff. So I certainly wouldn't envy HSE for the work that they have to go through now to rebuild that network.
Yeah. That kind of it answers the next question that I was going to ask, really, which was why does it take so long to restore services after such an attack when you have a decryption key? But I think you probably just explained it very well of you know, what all of the steps that need to be taken and probably why it's going to cost so much. There's the work involved in recovering, but I guess there's also, you know, there's going to be costs and attempting to beef up their security to try and, you know, avoid this happening again.
Yeah, like, I think it's, you know, it's one thing, I think, against a private corporate company where probably you have most machines are very likely all running the same version of Windows. Most machines are probably the same hardware, even, you know, for example, all of our laptops are the same, exact same devices, and they're rotated every 4 or 5 years or so. My understanding is the HSE is different. You know, they have older machines where, for example, you've got, you know, fairly niche hospital equipment which requires specific versions of operating systems and things like that. So it's an unusual environment probably to have to rebuild as well, given the varied type of equipment that's in there. And of course, that's going to slow things down as well. Never mind, as you mentioned earlier on, the size of it, multiple different hospitals all over the country. Maybe in some cases, they can't even do some of the work remotely. And so they have to physically travel to various hospitals and so on to rebuild things. So yes, it's a staggering job to have to do that amount of work. And it sounds like, I'm pretty sure the people doing it have been doing it 24/7 for the past 2 weeks. So quite exhausting and yes, expensive in manpower to pay for that type of resource. Because it requires a very skilled resource to do that type of work.
Well, thanks for joining us, Gavin. That was incredibly interesting. We're going to continue talking about ransomware now because as Bridget is going to speak about, another large company has also been hit this week.
Yeah, so food processing giant JBS Foods revealed on Sunday that it had been forced to shut down production at several of its sites worldwide following a cyber attack. So the company said that the attack, which occurred just at the weekend, which was Memorial Day weekend in the States, I suppose, impacted multiple production facilities around the globe, including those in the US, as well as other facilities in Australia and Canada and Europe as well, I think. And JBS Foods is a Brazilian headquartered company, but it is actually the world's largest meat producer, and it employs almost 250,000 people worldwide in multiple countries, including in America and Australia and Europe. And some of the plants were canceling work shifts on Monday and Tuesday of this week. So it does seem that the impact of this attack was ongoing into early this week anyway.
Okay. And how did we find out it was a ransomware attack?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we see attacks, leading to high levels of disruption these days, we always generally assume it is ransomware because it normally is. But we actually had that confirmed in a statement from the White House, which said that it had been notified by JBS on Monday that it had been the victim of a ransomware attack. And JBS reportedly slaughters around 20% of cattle in the US. So I would imagine that if the attack has a long-term impact on operations, there could be concerns there about supply chain issues and that kind of thing, which I presume is why the White House is probably being brought into this. And the White House said that it is engaging directly with the Russian government on this matter and delivering the message that responsible states do not harbour ransomware criminals. So much like Gavin was talking about there, the kind of geopolitical implications of ransomware kind of coming into play again. And the White House also said that both the FBI and CISA were working with JBS to investigate this incident as well.
Yeah, I think this is the second ransomware attack in about 2 or 3 weeks that the White House has felt compelled to comment on.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Gavin mentioned earlier, and we spent a lot of the last podcast talking about the Colonial Pipeline attack and the various implications of that and the various responses to it, which also included, commentary from the White House and commentary then directed at Russia as well during that attack, because, as we said, DarkSide ransomware gang, which carried out that attack, is, widely reported to be acting out of Russia. And since the last podcast as well, actually, the US Department of Homeland Security has issued a security directive for the oil and gas pipeline industry following that ransomware attack on Colonial. And this directive replaces what were voluntary guidelines that have been in place for over a decade. And it will be administered by CISA and the Transportation Security Administration of the Department of Homeland Security. And the directive will require now critical pipeline owners like Colonial and others to report any confirmed or potential cybersecurity incidents to CISA. And they must also have a designated cybersecurity coordinator who is available 24/7. And as well as that, they expect pipeline owners and operators to review their current practices and to identify any gaps and related remediation measures they need to take and to report these results to the TSA and to CISA within 30 days. And the TSA said it would also consider further follow-on mandatory measures that would further support the pipeline industry in enhancing its cybersecurity. So that's quite a, quick response, I suppose, to that ransomware attack. And it just goes to show, the impact of these kind of attacks now and these kind of measures and these kind of responses, from the White House. And, what we were discussing about the HSE attack, as we were saying, they all show how ransomware, particularly now, is really transcending being a cybersecurity issue. And it is becoming, nearly a social and a political issue, due to the big impacts we can see of ransomware attacks on key organizations like healthcare or transport or food production. They provoke responses from all sides of the kind of community, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it really kind of has stepped up a notch in recent weeks in terms of the gravity of the threat. And the Irish Health Service, it wasn't the only health service to be impacted by a cyber attack in the last few weeks, I don't know.
Yeah, and while this one doesn't appear to be as serious as the incident that affected the Irish healthcare system, the Swedish Public Health Agency came out last week and said that it had to temporarily shut down SmyNet, which is its infectious disease database. And SmyNet, which also stores information about the country's COVID-19 statistics, was taken offline last Thursday, 27th of May, for around 24 hours. And while it has come back online, the Swedish authorities are saying that the investigation is continuing and no updates on the country's COVID-19 statistics were expected until at least today, if not longer. And authorities said that they're investigating if any sensitive personal data was accessed as well, and that they're also working to rectify any deficiencies in their systems. And I suppose, yeah, as I said, while this wasn't as serious as Irish case, you know, does also serve to kind of underline that health services, you know, they clearly are a target for some of these unscrupulous actors, and they do need to be aware of that.
Yeah. Finally, now I think we have some non-ransomware things to discuss because I think you noticed that the Mexican police had arrested the alleged head of an ATM fraud gang who are supposed to have stolen more than $1 billion.
Yeah, I felt this was more of like, yeah, old school kind of cybercrime topic for us to cover. So yeah, change from ransomware. But yeah, authorities in Mexico last week arrested the alleged head of an organized crime gang that, as you said, is accused of defrauding tourists to the country of more than $1 billion through corrupted ATMs. So he's a Romanian native, Florian Tudor, who is known as the Shark. He was arrested amid quite dramatic scenes in Mexico last week in response to an extradition request from a court in Romania. And a video of Tudor's arrest was posted online by various Mexican media outlets, and they showed shouting and brawling and Tudor being eventually carried out of the building he was in by his arms and legs by arresting officers. So, you know, kind of like something you'd see on the telly or something, really. And Tudor is alleged to be the leader of a gang that has dubbed the Riviera Maya Gang. And they've allegedly compromised more than 100 ATMs across various popular tourist spots in Mexico, including places like, you know, Cancun and Tulum and places that people would go on holidays, obviously, when that was something that we could do. And apparently they were using skimmers that were able to remain in place undetected on these ATMs for several years. So this was ongoing kind of operation over a long period of time. And yeah, I suppose showing a huge amount of money involved in these kinds of operations, authorities estimated that the gang used clone card data and stolen pins to steal more than $1.2 billion from ATM users. So that's obviously serious money. And I suppose it just shows that it's not just the ransomware criminals who are making huge amounts of money in the kind of cybercrime underworld at the moment, unfortunately.
No, indeed, that's a staggering amount of money. I'm always amazed at how lucrative some of these cybercrime operations are for their perpetrators. Okay, thanks, Bridget. That's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.